So, I once found myself having dinner in the same restaurant as Bono. I watched him closely, as one does in a restaurant when a major rock star is eating less than 13 feet away from you. I'll spare you the details of how he handles his rapini, but at one point in the meal, he noticed I was watching him, and he gives me a nod and the look, the specific look that says, "Yes, I'm a rock god. I eat too, and I think it would be pleasant for both of us if you went back to your fusilli with sausage." So I did. I'm David Hurley, and this is The Hurley Burley, my podcast on politics, music, sports, business, and culture. Welcome to part two of our podcast with Rob Bowman, musicologist, Grammy Award winner, and globally recognized pop music expert. In today's episode, we're going to have some fun talking about who belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and who doesn't, and who's going to matter in history from pop music and who won't. But most of what we're going to talk about today is the intersection of music and politics, and drawing on Rob's expertise about protest music in the southern United States in the 1960s and 70s, we're going to talk about music in today's troubled, sometimes ugly culture. Welcome to the Hurley Burley. I'm David Hurley. You're obviously familiar with Chuck Klosterman.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So Chuck Klosterman wrote an essay in which he asked this question. Hundreds of years from now, when somebody like you is teaching the history of music.
If I'm teaching 100 years from now, I will have had a very long, fulfilling life. Great.
When somebody like you
is
teaching music, and they're getting to the rock era, he suggests that it will have been distilled down to one exemplar artist. And in the way that he says, for instance, marching band music, the only person anybody knows is Sousa.
Right.
But it was a thriving, at one point, genre with a lot of people who played it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Only people know Sousa now. So he says, who is the only rock artist we're going to remember? And he starts with, well, it obviously would be the Beatles. But no, he goes through a number of reasons. And why isn't it the Stones? Why isn't it Presley? Why isn't it Dylan? And he arrives at Chuck Berry. Right? Because he thinks that Chuck Berry best exemplifies the myths of rock and roll, of danger and criminality and drug use and R&B.
I don't know if he actually says any of that, but he's wrong if he did, because Chuck didn't write songs about drug use and criminality. Chuck,
no, but he had a criminal background. He's a wild man, is what he was saying.
Okay.
Right? So, how do you answer the Chuck Klosterman question?
Well, I think it's a foolish question, and I think it's based on a false premise. If you look at the marching band era, it was relatively short, and Sousa dominated even in that time. So you can say, okay, well, Elvis dominated, or the Beatles dominated, or Dylan dominated. We can find dominant people. But it wasn't like rock and roll whose history has now spanned close to 70 years. When we look at the classical period, Beethoven's dominant. But nobody's ignoring Mozart. Nobody's ignoring Haydn. There are other massive stars of the era. Very few people remember Smetana.
Right, but so you...
Or Stamich. In other words, there are people who have receded in history who once had a second-level importance in the era. But it's not just one person who's survived. And so just for a 70-year period, we're going to have one iconic artist. I mean, Chuck Berry, I think, will survive. I think he will be an iconic artist. But he won't be the only one. Elvis Presley will be up there. Certainly the Beatles, the Stones, and Dylan will be up there. The Sex Pistols, probably, believe it or not, even if you don't like that. And I wouldn't be surprised. Springsteen's going to be there. You know, I'm kind of hoping that the White Stripes or Jack White, his whole career, Public Enemy should be there. There's so, you know, I'm leaving out a billion things because I haven't really thought this through in a big, big, big way. But I'll meet you in 100 or 200 years and we'll have a look. And I'm sure that there'll be at least 20 iconic artists in the same way that we can talk about Bach, we can talk about Liszt, we can talk about Handel, let alone when we get to Brahms, Haydn, Beethoven, Mahler.
But it does shrink, right? It does shrink.
Well, it has to shrink.
So
the 50s has shrunk. How many people know who Billy Lee Riley is? Flying Saucers Rock and Roll, one of the great records ever. But you don't, you know.
The biggest artists in the world are reduced to their greatest hits catalog now in terms of what really people remember, and when they go out on tour, they have to play that. I read your interview with Grace Slick, and I think it was...
You read that?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think it was in 1972, and I could tell from reading it, and it was true, that rock and roll had been around for about 7 years at that point in time, and the Jefferson Airplane were one of the biggest bands of that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But 45 years later, their role has shrunk to a very narrow niche corner, right? So it may not be one. But nobody's going to remember Bon Jovi at the end of this, right?
Thank God. Nobody should remember him right now. I'm sure John won't hire me to do his next boss set. That's okay. I'm good with that. I turn him down anyway. Nobody should remember Journey either. I'm going to really piss some people off here. And Kiss is a band that I just wish would go away because they represent everything that's not rock and roll, which is why, of course... I won't even go there. I was going to go to politics, but I won't go there. But of course, you're right.
Why? What's the point?
No, I'm not going to go there because I want to still be able to travel. So I'm not going there. Mm. Anyway, of course, you're right. You have an unbelievable wealth of, we'll say, information chunks, which we can call pieces of music, songs, classical pieces, and anyone. Your average person is only going to be aware of so many of those chunks, if you will.
Right.
And that will shrink over time as we move in history. And the average person is still going to have X number of chunks in their head, but there's all these new chunks that keep coming along. And obviously, things get flushed out of the database, if you will. So the Airplane today, what do people know about them? If they even know they existed...
They know two songs.
They know two songs at best.
Yeah.
They'd be Somebody to Love and White Rabbit.
Yeah.
Although a second level of people who are a little more interested for whatever in 60s culture might know things like Volunteers and the idea of the Airplane being a slightly revolutionary up against the wall motherfuckers kind of band in that particular song. And they might know their Woodstock performance. But then there's people who dive deep and, you know, will go get all of those records. They're all still in print. They're all available. You can download them all today, or you can even get hard CD copies if you want to go to Amazon or Soundscapes in Toronto. Or Amoeba in L.A. They're available for those who care. And the fact they're available means that enough people are still buying them to make it economically worthwhile for the record company. Now, 100 years from now, will they all be? That's a question. And I can't answer that. But there will. It's just like right now. How many Bach pieces can you name for me?
None.
Oh, surely the Brandenburg Concerto. You at least could tell me that.
You know what? It's really classical music is a complete void in my...
Okay. But you've heard of Bach.
I have heard of Bach, yes.
Yeah, I would imagine, as have most people. But the reality is most people have heard of Bach, and they know he's important. Probably most of you couldn't even say exactly that he was actually in the Baroque period, not the classical period. But if you had to ask them to name pieces outside of the Brandenburg, they have to be at next level of interest. They have to be people who are much more serious. Mm. Then maybe they can start talking about different oratorios or, you know, the fugue in G minor or something, you know? And the same thing with Mozart. How many Mozart pieces can you name? Well, you're not into classical. But, again, most people can't name many. They recognize some melodies like Eine kleine Not music that they love to sing. Beethoven. Everybody knows.
Nine.
Everybody knows there's nine symphonies.
Yeah.
Which ones do you know?
Nine and five.
Yeah, those are the two big ones. Now you got the big hits. That's Somebody to Love and
White Rabbit.
Yeah. Most people don't know 1, 2, 3, and 4, let alone 6, 7, and 8. And they probably don't even really know 9 and 5 very well. They know da-da-da-da. They, of course, know the big riff, just like everybody knows Louie Louie or, you know, Wild Thing. But that's all they know. But it's all out there. And for those who decide this is fascinating stuff, they dig deeper. And of course, everything Beethoven ever wrote, there's plenty of versions out there. You can hear it, you can learn it, you can read about it, you can study it, you can become immersed in it if you care. And that will be the same for all of these rock people I'm talking about. So Jefferson Airplane, sure, your average person even now barely knows who they are. But those who care, and there's plenty, can dive as deep as they want. And I think that'll be true 100 years from now. But will you be able to hear all the Country Joe and the Fish records?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Probably bothers you a lot, that Grace Slick is known to more people for We Built This City than for somebody to love?
I don't know about a lot. I don't think about it very much. But when you bring it up, I find it kind of cringe-worthy, yes.
We've got to talk about Memphis.
Yeah, sure.
We got to talk about Memphis. The reason we have to talk about Memphis is because it's been your life's work, effectively. You've lived there for extended periods of time. You wrote your PhD dissertation about Memphis music. You spearheaded the rebuilding of the Stax recording studio and museum on the original site in Memphis. You wrote a book about that whole experience called Soulsville, USA, which is a fantastic book.
And it's in the Blues Hall of Fame.
So all of that is fascinating, and I want to talk to you about that. So Otis Redding turned you on to R&B.
Absolutely. Well, the Stones turned me on to Otis.
Right.
And Otis was my first R&B.
You went out trying to buy a Stones song, and you couldn't find it, so you bought Try a Little Tenderness.
No, not true. The Stones had covered That's How Strong My Love Is.
Right.
Based on Otis's version, although I later learned Ovie Wright did it before Otis, which is where Otis got it from. But I adored the way Mick sang it. And I remember Mick talking in an interview about Otis Redding. So I went to Eaton's, which is one place he used to buy records before record stores were ubiquitous. Of course, now they're no longer ubiquitous. And I asked about That's How Strong My Love Is. And they didn't have that, but they had Otis's newest single, which was Try a Little Tenderness.
Right.
That took that home. And it's suddenly like, again, it's sort of like when I first heard the Beatles, suddenly like, what the heck are these sounds? My world just changed. It didn't make the Stones lesser. A lot of people sort of have those moments where all the Stones are, you know, whatever, when I heard the real thing. That didn't do it to me at all. The Stones were still amazing. But it did open up torrents of experience that I had never had before. And it's still one of my favorite records ever. And it started me on a pursuit to go deeper and deeper and deeper into that particular area of music. You know, a year or two later, again because of the Stones, I started chasing post-war Chicago blues. People like Muddy and Howlin'Wolf, which I adore as well. They didn't become my life's work.
But you made Stax records your life's work.
But let me put that in context. To a large degree, yes, and I've been pigeonholed that way, and I understand why. When I went to do my PhD, I wanted to live in the South. I wanted to live within the culture that had produced so much of the music that I cared about. I originally was going to go to New Orleans, and I would have done a PhD in New Orleans R&B, which is unbelievable stuff. Professor Longhair, you know, on up to the Meters and so on, and everybody in between, Jesse Hill, Irma Thomas, and so on. But Tulane's musical program, their ethnomusicology program, had fallen apart a year or two before I would have gone. So Memphis then seemed like a logical place. And when I went to Memphis, I could have been doing my dissertation on rockabilly. And I did interview a lot of the Sun Session musicians that I ended up publishing these interviews in the journal Country Music. I could have done it on post-war gospel quartets because the Memphis post-war gospel quartet tradition is amazing, and I've written extensively about that. I could have done it on the jug band tradition of the 20s in Memphis, which was extraordinary, and I teach about that all the time. I could have done it on Stax, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
I could have done it on High Records, which had an identifiable sound to Al Green, Syl Johnson, and so on.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I ended up picking Stax. But I'll tell you partially how it happened. I moved to Memphis late August. I unload my U-Haul. His friend, we go out to dinner. We go to some local pizza place. Young white waitress comes up to us, probably 23, 24. You know, how y'all doing, blah, blah, blah. And then she goes, oh, y'all not from here, are you? And, no, what are you doing here? Well, I come down to do my PhD. Oh, what are you going to do it on? And I mentioned all of the things. She'd never heard of Stax Records. This was 8 years only after Stax had gone bankrupt.
Right.
And it blew my mind. The institution in Memphis that had changed the world of music and was already unknown. And at that point, there were only 8 books on Motown. Now there's about 45 or 50. But there's 8 then. There is not a single book on Stax. Peter Grelnick's Sweet Soul Music, which has 150 pages on Stax, came out about 4 years later. And I thought, this is interesting. Somebody needs to do something about this. And I became a man with a mission. But it wasn't as if that was my only interest, or that's even the only reason I went to Memphis. That was one of a series of possibilities. Turned out to be a great choice, and it was an amazing adventure. I spent years researching it, interviewed over 200 people, built that museum you talked about, did 75 Stax reissues, won a Grammy for my work on Stax, got nominated for several other Grammys for my work on Stax. It still dominates a huge part of my life. Booker T and the MGs just flew me down to Memphis because he wanted me to see his new band do a Stax review. It's still a huge, huge, huge part of my life. But so is Bob Dylan, who I just did a box set with.
God, that city, Memphis, is amazingly segregated, eh? Like, it's a great... I was there for a weekend once, and my God, the music's amazing. I saw Ann Peebles in a club.
Oh, lucky you.
Unbelievable.
I love Ann.
Yeah,
God.
Crazy.
Which club?
I think it was in B.B. King's.
Okay. You're lucky you got to see Ann. That's great. She didn't perform a lot.
But I had, in 1979, I was living in Regina, grew up in Regina, and I'd met a football player who played for Saskatchewan. He came from Memphis State University.
Oh, really? Who was he?
His name was Lloyd Patterson.
Okay.
He was an All-American for Memphis State University quarterback.
Right.
And he was describing to me a world in which there were separate drinking fountains. In Regina in 1979, this made no sense to me whatsoever. But then in the late 90s, I go to Memphis, and I end up at a cab. And the cab driver is explaining how tourism, the economy is terrible in Memphis. And he said because the Asian tourists used to come for Graceland, and they don't come anymore since Lisa Marie married that N-word. Actually, it took me a while to figure out who he was talking about. He was talking about Michael Jackson.
Right.
Right? Okay. But that just seems like a crazy racially imbalanced place.
When I lived in Memphis, it was 83 to 86. Memphis' population is 50% black, 50% white, virtually like that.
And the whites live in a place called Germantown,
of them do. But there's only 5% integrated housing in Memphis. So you got a population that's 50-50, only 5% of the city is actually integrated. Not by law, but by custom. On principle, lived in an integrated neighborhood.
Right.
In that time, my house was broken into, my car was vandalized twice, I faced guns twice. Somebody tried to force my wife into a car. Fortunately, they were not successful. I knew people who's had their kids killed, friends killed, and this is just my small little orbit. Dangerous kind of city. And so many people said to me, you're nuts living there. Move out, east, which is where Germantown is. But there's other white areas, not just Germantown. And I wouldn't on principle. And, I lived in a place called Midtown. And right close to the city's great punk and new wave club, The Antenna, at that time. And I used to go to Al Green's church every Sunday. He used to call me the Caucasian brother from the pulpit. For $2 in a collection plan, I'd see Elvis singing 2 to 5 songs every week. It was great. But you'd go into a restaurant. There'd be a white hostess, white waiters or waitresses, black busboys, black cooks. Everywhere you saw segregation, even though there was no longer separate drinking fountains, separate washrooms, all the things that had been part of the 60s that Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement had struck down. That no longer existed, but segregation was everywhere. And Memphis has improved a lot, even when you went. It's a lot better than when I lived there.
Right.
And now it's a lot better than when you went. I go back twice a year for my work. But it's still a backwards, racially messed up place. And it's kind of sad, but oddly enough, and this is even sadder in some ways, that confluence of ugly history ended up producing a greater number of incredibly important musics than any other city in the United States. That includes New York, LA, and Nashville. All those centers produce great music, but not the diversity that came out of Memphis.
So Sun Records, American Sound Studios, Chips Moman's operation.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Right? High Records and Stax Records, all in this relatively small city, right?
Right.
Memphis is not a big city.
And you haven't even talked about jug bands part of the post-war blues tradition of B.B. King and Bobby Bland, which is entirely different than a Chicago tradition or anything happening anywhere else. Mm-hmm. You haven't talked about the gospel quartet tradition. You haven't talked about the Church of God in Christ and that music. I mean, it's a you haven't talked about, the whole Alex Chilton big star pop thing that happened there.
Right,
too. I mean, it's unbelievable what came out of Memphis. It's an extraordinary place that I would never want to live in permanently.
I want to get political on you for a second.
Okay.
Because when I think about R&B and black music in the 60s and early 70s, I think a lot about protest music, and I think a lot about the role of music in cultural change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're living in a pretty ugly period of time right now.
We are.
And I think there's a lot of ugly social forces that are gaining strength. I'm wondering what you think the potential for music is to play a role in.
I developed a course 4 years ago called African American Music and the Quest for Survival, Dignity, and Equal Citizenship. And it's really a course about oppositional music. I phrase it that way because, of course, in slavery days, you had spirituals, which couldn't be that oppositional, but were certainly about psychological survival, giving a sense that it was possible to get up north or heaven was going to be a different space and so on. But it allows me to teach everything from spirituals up to hip-hop. And, of course, early hip-hop is rife with lots of protest music, whether it be the great works of Public Enemy or Boogie Down Productions or even Grandmaster Flash with things like The Message. But now, given what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years, so much of it caught, fortunately, on cell phone cameras, which has made things that have been going on forever in terms of the way police treat black males very, very visible and repeated ad infinitum on the news. We have, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement. And we have a ton of people, Common being one easy example, who are writing cogent, fascinating, hard-hitting, insightful material that's dealing with that. You probably have more oppositional songs coming out of black artists now than you may have ever had in the past. And there's plenty in the past. There's plenty. But you've got a plethora of them because our modern news media and our modern technology of cell phones have allowed so much of this stuff to be documented and given people, roused people's anger, but also given people material to write about.
Right. So is the potential impact of that blunted by the silos music is in now? So if you were...
Good question.
If you were a white kid in the early 70s, you would have had to work not to hear Living in the City by Stevie Wonder. Because it would have been on the radio. You would have had... Now...
But if you're a white...
Now, you could easily not hear any of the music you're talking about if you didn't seek it out.
Fair enough. I'll problematize one thing you said, though. If you're a white kid in the early 70s, you'd hear Living in the City, but you'd never hear James Brown Get Up Into It, Get Involved, and all of that stuff.
Okay.
Right. Funky President, It's Bad. You wouldn't hear those at all. Yeah. After Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud in 68, you didn't hear James on white radio to Living in America in 85. Big. In fact, the early 70s were a terrible period for white people to really hear what was going on in black music. There were certain artists that crossed over, Stevie being a big example, but there was a lot of stuff. Most white people didn't hear Soulsville by Isaac Hayes, even. I'd be careful about romanticizing just how things worked back then. Black and white radio were still very segregated. Certain things crossed over. So now we're really siloed. We don't just have black and white radio. We have people only listen to electronica. We have people only listen to hip-hop. We have only people listen to metal. We have people only listen to so-called classic rock. I mean, let alone country and all these other things. I teach my students, they don't even know each other. When I first started teaching in 79, when I was 22, that's when I taught my first university course, I could assume that all the students had heard virtually the same stuff.
Right.
And I was about their same age, so we had all heard, we had the same cultural reference points. It's no longer true. My students can't even speak to each other because their musical interests are so disparate and separated. And we have a world with, a billion channels, if you will, of music delivery. both, you know, satellite, online, and then regular terrestrial radio, that people only listen to this, this, or this. That said, especially in the hip-hop world, lots of white kids do tune in.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of white kids do hear black artists. And then there's white artists like Eminem who makes black music, who, have you seen his anti-Trump screed?
It's hilarious.
It's powerful.
I was about to say it's very powerful.
Hilarious isn't a word I'd use because it's extraordinary.
Well, sorry, I used hilarious because I hate Trump so much.
Okay.
All right, and I just really enjoyed him.
Got it.
Laying into it like that.
It's insightful. It's not just vehemence. I hate the, you know, MF, blah, blah, blah. It's unbelievably informed and critical. And anybody who cares about Eminem, let alone that thing's gone viral, so tons of people have seen it, but certainly any Eminem fan, especially when he draws the line in the sand. If you're a fan of his, you are not a fan of mine. I don't want you. And then he gives the finger at the end. But if you listen to his analysis throughout that song and you care at all and you're an intelligent person, you start researching stuff you don't already know about it, you become informed. Maybe you become an activist.
Right.
Whether it's on a small grassroots level or maybe you become somebody on a slightly more prominent level. Either way, I'm talking about the power of music to, in fact, educate and potentially even radicalize.
Does it do it kind of in a subversive way, Rob? Well, like, against you, you know, maybe without you even knowing it, it seeps into your head and starts to change the way you think?
It can. I mean, you can just be an Eminem fan and you hadn't planned to really get political, but since he's got political, you become sensitized, so I guess you could call it subversive. Maybe indirect might be a better way. A better way of putting it, I'm not sure. But, of course, and then there's other people who search stuff out. Other people search out all the oppositional material that's coming out of various artists at this moment in time. And, you know, I think that's always been true. I remember when the U.S. went in and started bombing Iraq, CBC phoned me up and they wanted me to do a show on anti-war songs. They wanted a brief history, but they wanted me to concentrate on the Iraq situation. There was tons of them. I mean, there's tons of stuff. And some stuff, again, just internet only. Some stuff never actually put for sale, just made and put up on the internet. And by major artists like, you know, Michael Franti, Bomb the World into Peace. I can't remember the actual title. Is that the title? But it's a great, great, great song. I remember that had just been dropped on the internet a day or two before. It's been the early days of having to figure out how to download the darn thing so I could play it on CBC, which we did. Music always meets its social moment, and of course the majority of music will always be about basic human condition, which is falling in love and falling out of love. That's what, you know, we're all looking for love. People are always looking for lasting relationships, whether they're primarily sexual when you're 14 or they're of a different level when you're 55. They still could be primarily sexual, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's always going to be dominant, but at the same time, there are always musical artists who will write songs that address what's happening in the world around them, both within their specific communities and in a greater sense about their country, the world, on a global sense, and so on. And that material will get out to people, and that will affect people. So much of who and what I am as a social being, which automatically means it's a political being, politics are social. They're about what your values, and your values are who you are socially. So, you know, you can say I'm conservative, I'm liberal, or I'm Democrat, I'm Republican. Those are political affiliations, but they're also about social values.
Mm.
And music's always going to deal with social values. You get music that very much pushes the Republican agenda in certain genres. You get music that very much pushes a Democrat agenda in certain genres. And you get plenty of music, of course, that feels both parties are largely irrelevant.
There's very little right-wing rock and roll.
Well,
tell that to
Ted Nugent and Kid Rock.
Well, yeah, but I'm...
And Kiss.
You bring them up because they're the exceptions to the rule.
And fair enough. That's true.
Right. You're right. So how do conservatives listen to rock music?
Well, a lot of them listen to Born in the USA and only listen to the chorus and pump their fists in the air, think it's a great song of patriotism.
Right.
I just saw Bruce Springsteen on Broadway. It's an amazing show. Bruce does a long story about how he got radicalized about the way Vietnam veterans were being treated in the United States. And he began to understand how wrong this was. And here's a guy who dodged the draft by faking things when he went down for his interview. And talks about that. And talks about he sometimes goes to Washington and sees that memorial to the dead people in Vietnam. Thinks, is there a name on there that went in my place? It's a heavy thought when you think about it. By getting out of it, somebody else had to go. And he recognizes there's a certain culpability. But he uses all of that as a way of eventually playing Born in the USA. But when he plays that, he's talked about meeting all these Vietnam vets and finding out about stuff. And he goes, this is a protest song. And he points his finger at the audience. A protest song. The chorus, or the verses are vignettes about the experiences of these people. The chorus is proclaiming their right as men and women to say they were born in the USA because this is a country that they risked their lives and many of them died for. And he plays this as a slide blues piece, really slowed down. And it's unrecognizable from the sort of fist-pumping rock and roll anthem we
Reagan
all know.
Political commercial in 1984 that it was.
And Bush used it, too. There's been several politicians who've misused it. And I know when Bruce has talked about some of these things in concerts, you occasionally get... I remember seeing Bruce do a benefit for Obama, and Bruce fans, you know, being upset about this, some of them who are right-wing, because, of course, they just ignore the lyrics. But you know what? That's another thing we could get into. How many people process lyrics, period? Brown Sugar by the Rolling Stones. Racist song. Misogynistic song. Hate to say it because it's a band I love.
Right. And it's a song I love.
And it's, of course, got a great riff. It's, but it's an ugly song.
Yeah.
So it's Under My Thumb, which isn't racist, but certainly
misogynistic.
I find
I don't sing along with those songs as much when I hear them.
But it's interesting. You look at audiences, you see a lot of women singing along to songs like Bitch, Brown Sugar, Under My Thumb. These are all very misogynistic songs. When those women are singing along, are they processing the lyrics, or are they simply singing sounds that are the syllables that are the lyrics? Studies have shown that when you quiz the majority of people about what hit songs mean, songs that they've heard over and over and over and over, most people can't give you any kind of informed answer. Most people know the catchphrases, Brown Sugar, How Come It Tastes So Good? Or Jumpin' Jack Flash is a gas, gas, gas. I do this all the time. Jumpin' Jack Flash, which is not a racist or misogynist song, I say to my students, what's it about? I go, how many times do you think you've heard it, even if you don't like them? I'm sure you've heard it at least 50 times without trying, probably a couple hundred. What's the song about? Tell me some of the lyrics besides the chorus.
Okay.
Vast majority can't. Every once in a while, one person can, is a big Stones fan or sang in a band or something.
Yeah.
And that's simply the way people process popular music. I think any music. Well, I'll say popular music because I think folk music, people are much more tuned into what the words are about, partially the way they're foregrounded musically. So conservatives hearing rock and roll don't need to process the words, just like women who are intelligent and I'll suggest progressive might be, you know, hearing some misogynistic stuff and being able to not really pay attention and not be disturbed by it.
Cool. I got a couple things I want to wrap up with you before we run out of time here. One of which is the state of rock journalism. I'm really interested.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Well, I'm really interested in the state of journalism, period, which is terrible, which I think is a crisis for our democracy and our society, not to have credible sources of information. It may not be a crisis not to have great rock music journalism or popular music journalism. But I've noticed a couple of things, one of which is that, like everything, the formats are disappearing, and I don't know how much longer Rolling Stone's going to be around.
Or if it even should be around.
Well, the nature of it's changed so much. Like, for instance, does anybody get a bad review in Rolling Stone magazine?
That I know of.
Anymore?
I don't even read them. But to be honest, when was the last time I read a review in Rolling Stone? It's been a while.
So what's happened there? Like, what are they trying to do? Curry a favor? Like, to go back to my artist, Elton John will put out a new record now,
right,
which I will like because I'm a fan. And Rolling Stone will give it 4 or 5 stars. But back in 1973, they gave Goodbye Yellow Brick Road 3 stars, right? So the new Elton John record is not better than Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. I will assure you of that.
I would agree.
So what's the deal?
Well, We are in a soundbite culture, and it's partially because of technology and the kinds of unbelievable amount of information hurled at us constantly from every direction, the amount of media sources available to us. So everything has become quick and short. If you look at the length of reviews in magazines, they're much shorter than they used to be. Look at the length of features, they're much shorter than they used to be. Magazines like Rolling Stone depend, and they always have depended, on ads to survive. Subscription and retail sales do not even begin to pay their costs. They're just a little bit of extra money. It's ads, and those ads are taken out by whom? They're taken out by record companies. And I think Jan Wenner, although, you know, I can't say this factually, probably for a long time now, although he's trying to sell Rolling Stone, but I think for a long time now, has basically been about, well, we're not going to write bad reviews. We're not going to write about records that you don't like. We're not going to bite the hand that feeds us, which are those major record companies, which effectively makes the reviews kind of useless. But, you know, the ranking of records with stars, I'm not even so sure that's so important. It's what gets said in the review. And what I find is very little gets said. Most people writing reviews, A, don't understand music. So they can talk about the lyrics. They can talk about attitudes. They can talk about, maybe try to put in a little context, but when they're often writing 200 words, there's no room for context. Patti Smith called me the other week. We were talking about a project together, and she was lamenting the state of rock journalism. She said it was always bad, and she was right about that, and now it's just terrible. The best writing about music tends to be in book form, by people who care enough to go that deep. And, of course, they only have to care enough, they care enough to go that deep, but the books don't make people very much money, so they got to decide, I'm not doing it for the money, which is great in some ways, except, of course, it'd be nice if they could support themselves doing it.
Yeah.
I don't have that worry. I got a university gig, which is great, and I feel very grateful to have it, so I can go write books, and I don't care if I make money. I don't care if I make money doing anything, although I'm happy to get paid, because I got a gig that takes care of my basic needs. But writers who are depending on their living have a very, very hard time. But those who are really good, we're going to go do it anyway, just like artists are going to make music anyway, even when they can't make money making records in the current music industry. They're still going to make those records.
What do you think about the online sources? Like, if I actually really want to understand a record, I'm more likely to go to, say, Pitchfork now than I am to go to Rolling Stone.
Sure, and that makes a lot of sense to me. Pitchfork is a much better source than Rolling Stone. The world is slowly moving online. There's still some good magazines. Wire still does some good stuff. Obviously, Mojo and Uncut, but tend to look more back at older music.
Yeah.
Although they're more and more also doing some current stuff. There are places online, and even maybe more important than magazines, we'll call Pitchfork an online magazine, is websites, listservs devoted to a genre or artist. That's where you can really find out about stuff. And yeah, you get a lot of people who aren't very informed who post things that are not very insightful. But you also get people who do post insightful things. So if you're willing
to sort through,
to ferret through it, that's where you can really get, and of course you quickly, it's like critics. You know, when I was young, you began to recognize, what critics could I trust? What critics, if they tell me this record's really special and I've never heard it, but I know I can go waste some money on it and it's not going to be a waste actually. Well, you begin to learn, you know, certain listeners, who's posting and whose stuff do you find actually pretty meaningful and whose stuff is just not even worth reading. And of course you zero in on that. It's just time efficiency. So there's still a lot of conversation and discourse. What is reviews? Reviews are discourse about music. Discourse is you and me talking about music. Discourse are people online, ordinary human beings who aren't getting paid, who aren't privileged in any way, just love music and spend time with it. Typing into their desktop and sending, or their laptop and sending stuff out into the virtual world that all of us get to read. That's happening all the time. And some of it's intelligent, because there's intelligent people who care deeply. A lot of it's not, and you just got to sort through it if you care.
Yeah. My last question should be a fun note. Who did you vote for this year to enter the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Do you remember, or should I refresh your memory with the ballot?
Well, you can do that if you want, but I remember most of who I voted for. I voted for the Meters.
Okay.
I voted for the MC5.
Okay.
I voted for Nina Simone.
Yay.
Yeah, damn right. I'm always the outsider vote, right? And a lot of people I vote for seem to never get in. Those are three of the five I voted for. I voted for the Zombies. That would be a fourth.
Okay.
And maybe Chaka Khan and Rufus.
Now, why do the Zombies, whom I love, she's not there as much as the next person.
Odyssey and Oracle.
Why do the Zombies belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? You said earlier that there's probably bands in there that don't belong in there. I'm wondering if it's too easy to get in there.
The Zombies
had a few hits, but, you know, there's lots of 50-goal scorers who are not in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Okay, first of all, I think it is too easy. I think Rock and Roll Hall of Fame made a mistake early on. They let far too many artists in right away, which meant they have a problem later on because so many greats are already there. So who are they going to put in this year or last year or next year and so on? I think, and that's a problem that's not going to go away because you can't take people out who are already in there. So, but then the question becomes, who belongs and who doesn't, given the current state of things? And you said, you know, the Zombies only had a few hits. She's not there, tell her no, time of the season. There's only three, really. If it was just based on hits, no, they don't deserve to be in there. Bob Seger's got a billion hits. He's in there. I'm not sure he deserves to be. I don't think he ever did anything special.
Yeah.
Although, funnily enough, pre-hit Bob Seger was a great bar band.
Live band, yeah.
Oh, great rock and roll band.
Yeah.
But you know, that's not necessarily good enough to get in. The Zombies have proven over time, especially with Odyssey and the Oracle, to have written a record on the same level as a Pet Sounds. And maybe if the hall wasn't so overstuffed
already.
The
name of that record is, because I don't know it.
It's called Odyssey and the Oracle.
Odyssey and the Oracle.
Yeah. Oh, my God, you don't know that record?
No, I'm going to have to go check it out right now.
Oh, my God, they just finished touring that record, just playing that record. That record's usually on the top 100 list of lots of people. It's an extraordinary album. It's like Pet Sounds in many ways. And ironically, the guy who toured and ran the band for Brian Wilson when he revived Pet Sounds toured with the Zombies when they revived Odyssey and the Oracle.
The Wonderbits?
Not the whole band, the leader of the Wonderbits.
Yeah.
The guy's a genius in terms of getting these arrangements, being able to get all those sounds from very complex records from that period live at this point in time. Anyway, the Zombies maybe wouldn't deserve to be in there if it wasn't already so overstuffed. They'd be like maybe 80 bands down the road. But given the current state of things, given the Dave Clark Fiver in there, and, you know, I love Bits and Pieces and Glad All Over, but the Zombies records are much more sophisticated and arguably more influential. They're sort of like the big star of that period. Now, will Big Star ever get in there? That's another question. Maybe they should. So that's why they're on my vote. I don't know if they'll get in or not. Usually, again, all the people I vote for don't get in.
It's a travesty that Nina Simone is not in.
I agree. And hopefully... it might go her way this year. I think it's a travesty the MC5 aren't in there. Talk about a band with no hits, but who changed the world in so many ways. It's beyond disgusting. And the Meters? I mean, New Orleans version of Booker T and the MGs. One of the funkiest groups you'll ever... I've flown to New York and New Orleans to see the Meters. I mean, they're one of the greatest groups ever. And, you know, of course...
It doesn't matter because Bon Jovi and the Cars are running away with the fan voting, so...
And why are we surprised?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's just really unfortunate. The idea of Bon Jovi going in there really makes me sick. And no offense to the Cars. So what? My Best Friend's Girl?
Yeah.
You know, an okay pop song. They didn't do anything special. They didn't change anything. They just had a couple big hits.
They made radio pretty good for a couple of years.
Well...
Yeah. But yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is that Hall of Fame material or not, right?
For me, it's not, but yeah. I wouldn't have put Bob Seger in either, and a lot of people see that as heresy.
Blondie, I was looking through the list, right? Blondie, really? Hall of Fame?
Yeah, that's questionable too, although, you know, Patti Smith and the Ramones and Talking Heads from that same period obviously should be in there.
Yeah.
And they are all in there. But Blondie, I wouldn't have gone there, personally. But
Love and Spoonful?
Probably. Although, you know, maybe on the outer edges are marginal, but they probably deserve it in their role in terms of popularizing folk rock.
Okay.
They were terrible, though, by the way, when they were inducted and they did the reunion.
Yeah.
One of the worst performances I've ever seen at the Hall of Fame. I go every year.
Yeah.
I write part of the program every year. So I've done it. This will be my 20th year, I think. So I've been lucky. I've seen some unbelievable things there. But the Lemon Spoonful reunion was one of the worst things I ever saw.
The jams are fun, though?
Oh, well, the jams used to be more fun in the early days because they truly were jams. Now they're kind of organized. Okay, we'll have Prince guest with, you know, Jeff Lynne and Danny Harrison to the tribute to George. And, of course, Prince steals it with that incredible solo while my guitar gently weeps. Or we'll have Neil Young play with the Pretenders when they're inducted. That's a group. Why were the Pretenders inducted? I mean, Brass in Pockets, a decent song, and, you know, 2,000 miles or whatever it is, 200 miles,
she's 2,000
miles.
She's an icon.
Yeah, but there's no good reason for it.
No, but she is.
But she doesn't deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. No. I don't think. She's second level. Maybe somewhere down the road. Now, again, a lot of people are going to hate me for this interview. I'll probably get hate mail all
day
long.
No, but it's a question of whether the Hall of Fame is for only the truly exalted or whether it's for anybody that was ever any good. The Pretenders were good.
Well, they were very good.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And that is a question. But if it's about if anybody was ever any good, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of quote, good bands. Why isn't Mitch Ryder in there then?
You know, I don't know.
He wasn't as iconic as Chrissie Hynde.
You would have thought Springsteen would have fixed that for him by now.
Well, he wasn't as iconic as Chrissie Hynde, but a damn good band. Just like the Pretenders were a damn good band. So, the Hall of Fame's a problematic institution, but it's better it exists than it doesn't.
For sure.
And if you ever go to Cleveland, it's extraordinary what you'll see there and what you might learn there. So, I support it. I do a lot of the interviews for the Educational Archive. We do 4 or 5 hour filmed interviews with inductees, which are amazing. I write part of the program every year. I'm on, I'm a voter. I'm not a nominator. That's a smaller group. I wish I was. I'd fight for a few things, but it doesn't even matter because even if you get them on the ballot, like the MC5, we can't seem to get them in. But I believe it's in its importance and we'll continue to keep supporting it.
Rob Bowman, I could talk about this with you for the rest of the day, but we've come to as much time as we can squeeze into a podcast. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about all these things today, and I'm going to have to stop by one of your classes or maybe audit one of your full classes.
Anytime you want.
Really understand what's going on in the world of music. Thanks a lot.
Cool. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you all for listening to the Hurly Burly today. If you have a minute or two, please give us a review on iTunes. It really does help get word around about the show, and the feedback helps us tinker and plan for future podcasts. Thanks again.